Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, October 10th. Today we take a look offshore to an urban wildfire in the Oakland Hills that took place 3 decades ago. What can we learn about the response to that fire and our response to the Maui wildfires? The hurricane that is barreling through Florida right now is leaving a path of destruction. It's a sobering situation. And for an island state that relies on our harbors as a lifeline, we thought it would be good to take a look at the Honolulu Harbor Modernization Project that is currently underway. And some say we have a child care crisis on our hands. We take a closer look at this social issue. And a new documentary about a female labor leader is about to debut on public television. We hear more about her story and the history of the working class in Hawaii. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It was 33 years ago this month that a wildfire swept through California's Oakland Hills neighborhood. It was an urban fire that we thought was worth revisiting, given the report on the Maui wildfires that was just released by the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives last week. HPR's Savannah Harriman-Pote joins us this morning. Good morning, Savannah.
Good morning, Catherine.
So what was it specifically about Oakland that you wanted to look at?
Yeah, so the Oakland Hills Fire, also known as the Tunnel Fire, has been eclipsed in people's memory by, for instance, the Campfire, Paradise, and of course, Lahaina. But going back to 1991, this was one of the most expensive fires in history at the time, and one of the first billion-dollar fires, right? It was also when we started to see fires in what we call wildland urban zones, so places where people have houses very close to wildlands that light on fire. 3,000 structures were burned, 25 people died, many were trapped trying to evacuate, as we saw in Lahaina. And also similarly to Lahaina, there was a reignition event. So firefighters responded to a fire one day, they were able to extinguish it, or so they thought, they left the scene, and the next day a huge windstorm reignited the fire and the blaze spread out of control. So based on those similarities and what this fire meant at the time, and the fact that the community of Oakland has had 30 years to work on its recovery, I wanted to know what lessons we could learn for communities like Lahaina, who are still in the very, very early days of figuring out what went wrong and making sure it never happens again. And I talked to a lot of people who were living in the Oakland Hills in 1991 about what that day was like, including Holly Kwan, who's a longtime radio reporter from the area. And she remembers seeing the fire approaching from her parents' house in the hills.
My parents live right in front of a highway. It's not a big highway, but it's a freeway. And you started seeing people like braking and then backing up the freeway. And I'm like, what's going on out there? And then you go out and you see this giant, you know, alien mothership looking cloud of smoke that's building towards you.
And just to give you a sense of how big this fire was, people across the bay could see it. So I also spoke with Larry Cherone, who is a retired KCBS news reporter and anchor, who saw the smoke from the fire all the way on the other side of the bay where he lived.
It was crazy because as I was driving to work, I live in the North Bay of the Bay Area, so I'm like 50 miles out. As I was driving in, and I was aware there was a fire, but I wasn't sure how big or how dangerous it was at the time, fire in the Oakland Hills. And I got down towards the Golden Gate Bridge, and I looked towards the left, towards the East Bay. And I don't know if you're familiar with the Golden Gate Bridge, when the fog rolls in from the Pacific, it floats in, and it's like a finger of giant whiteness coming over the bay. Well, this was the reverse. It was a big plume of black smoke flowing out the Golden Gate towards the Pacific Ocean as those winds, the Diablo winds, blew over the hills.
Yeah, very, very scary situation. I have a brother that lives in the Bay Area, and I remember the stories about this.
Yeah, and those Diablo winds were what kick-started the fire, and they were a critical player in that windstorm. Fortunately, Holly Kwan's parents' house survived the fire, as did the house of Elizabeth Stage, another Oakland Hills resident that I visited, but truly just barely. She told me the story when I went to see her in Oakland last week.
The house next to mine was fine. The next house over was completely blackened and charred on the uphill side. From the distance that we traveled, everything was gone. The winds shifted. If the winds had continued this way, all these houses would have gone. The utility pole across the street was blackened, same as that charred house. It was blackened up about 8 feet. And lying on the road, 20 feet long, was the nozzle of a fire hose and the fire hose. The canvas piece that was there had holes burnt in it. Imagine a high pressure of water in a canvas hose catching fire. That's what embers can do.
So what has the city of Oakland done to make itself, you know, more safe?
So there were a lot of investigations and reports that came out after this fire about what not just went wrong, but so wrong. Elizabeth Stage, for instance, had said if the winds hadn't shifted that day, this fire could have continued and burned throughout the entirety of Oakland. And so they found a lot of things that needed to be fixed. One was the Oakland Fire Department, as well as the East Bay Regional Parks District firefighters, were both responding to the fire that day. But their radios were on different channels, so they weren't able to communicate with each other effectively about the response. And then when other fire departments came to help, they couldn't hook up their hoses to the hydrants that were on the hill. They weren't compatible, so they couldn't get water to help fight the fire. And then there's this issue of reignition, which is one we're also considering in Lahaina, right? Everyone that I spoke to about this fire said that Oakland firefighters or responders from the area today would never leave the scene of a fire like that again. And one person I talked to actually compared the way firefighters watch a fire as sitting Shiva. So they really ensure that they are confident that that fire is out before they ever leave. I reached out to Oakland's emergency department to learn more about how that translates into exact protocols, because this is something that many people in Hawaii have a lot of questions about, right? After the Maui County and ATF investigation that came out last week that discussed how there was one fire in Lahaina that firefighters believed had been extinguished and then later in the day restarted. So how can you know? How can you be absolutely sure that a fire won't restart? That's something that I'm waiting to hear back from Oakland's emergency department about. And then the other ongoing challenge is vegetation management, right? So Oakland has put in a lot of protocols for maintaining vegetation around homes, but a lot of the work for vegetation management, especially in public spaces, is done by volunteers. Oakland is in a budget deficit. They need to conserve their resources. And so volunteers are making sure a lot of these public spaces are safe. And Elizabeth Stage, who is not only a wildfire survivor, but who is also the president of the Oakland Fire Safe Council, says that those partnerships are essential.
So a lot of these things require cooperation. And I think what I'd say to the people in Lahaina, if I were asked, would be getting these relationships, figure out what went wrong, but building relationships that are robust and outlast the individuals who were there, who are motivated by the experience, that takes years. And doing little things that might look inconsequential, but now we depend on the relationships to go the next step. And we make friends. We count on each other.
Yeah, that we do.
And the other thing that came up a lot in the conversations I've had with people who have been around the Oakland Hills for a long time is memory, right? For Elizabeth Stage and Holly Kwan, the memory is very, very vivid. But a lot of the people who live in Oakland Hills now weren't there in 1991 or weren't even alive yet. And Holly Kwan talked about how do we keep those people motivated again. Here's her talking.
30 years later, I'm hoping that the people will still remember that. they know not to do foolish things like, you know, have a fire pit or something in the backyard, or have something where sparks will fly, you know, or here's the other thing, you know, try and clearing the brush with a weed whacker on a hot day, and, you know, you hit a rock and boom, you spark something. That's happened before. So hopefully people are just more cognizant.
Yeah, we all need to do, oh my gosh, be vigilant and just be really careful given this fire.
Yeah, Catherine, I think what I learned from the Oakland Hills fire is recovery is not a place we arrive at and then we're done. It's something that we're going to be working on for the next decade and the decade after that and the decade after that.
Yeah, all right. Well, thank you so much, Savannah.
Thank you, Catherine.
That was Savannah Harriman-Pote talking to us about lessons learned from California wildfires. Look for stories on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
In 2020, we held a series of voter roundtables.
The American president should look at the world through the perspective of America.
The impacts of failed immigration policies and climate change policies.
He genuinely has the best of the American dream at heart.
Some of those voters are coming back to talk about their view of the nominees and the country this time around. That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering master programs in finance, information systems, marketing, and travel industry management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu.
First Hurricane Helene and now Hurricane Milton, two hurricanes in 2 weeks to hit the Florida coast. The devastation so far is scary. The images make us gulp and wonder about our vulnerabilities as an island state, so dependent on our harbors. So where are we on the modernization project for Honolulu Harbor, and more specifically, the Kapalama Container Terminal that harbor officials call KCT? It was started almost 7 years ago, and it was meant to help us make us more disaster resilient. We went on a tour of Kapalama yesterday afternoon with State Harbor's Deputy Director Dre Khalili. Standing on top of a mountain of sand on the harbor's edge, she gives us the bird's eye view.
If you look across the way at Sand Island, you can see just how much container cargo is delivered here to Honolulu Harbor. And we're hub and spoke, so everything's got to come here before it gets to our neighbor islands. And by opening up 84 more acres of cargo yard space, we can spread out that container operation. And so trucks can more quickly and efficiently get in, grab these containers that have been discharged off a vessel, and then off to the final destination, whether it's a store or, you know, someone's home or a business site. And the more space that we have, the more efficient these operations and cargo deliveries can happen. And we are a just-in-time, I mean, everyone says that they're a just-in-time supply chain, but we really are just-in-time. And so it's not infrequent that we see containers come off a ship, land on a cargo terminal, and then head straight to the parking lot of, you know, your neighborhood grocery store. So we really, for DOT, really want to do our part to make sure that our infrastructure can support that movement of cargo and that efficiency as best we can.
Now, that Kapalama project carries a price tag of about $500 million, and the construction site is bustling with heavy equipment on a windy day. Between massive concrete pours and waiting for the fill to settle in at the old Snug Harbor that used to be home to University of Hawaii at Manoa research vessels, officials are looking forward to the completion of this key piece of the harbor. Here's Khalili detailing the work to date to get the project closer to the finish line.
We expect to complete the construction of the Kapalama Container Terminal in about a year. And when the construction is complete, then we'll welcome Pesha Hawaii to move into the terminal and start their operations there from Piers 42 and 43.
And some of this is redundancy and just efficiency because we have an aging harbor.
That's absolutely correct. So when the combination of government and the private users who use our waterfront came together and thought of this, you know, much needed capital improvement project, you know, 20 and 30 years ago, the big idea was let's have a secondary terminal more than just Sand Island Container Terminal for exactly what you said. You know, we expected cargo volumes to grow. We'd need more space to efficiently run the movement of these containers. And that's really was the genesis for KCT. And so when you talk about redundancy in the aging harbor, yes, modernization is a big part of it, but it's that redundancy, having a secondary terminal and very important for our supply chain. And also, if you notice, Kapalama Container Terminal sits on the, I'm going to say, the other side of the Sand Island Bridge. So there are folks who will point to the bridge as an area of vulnerability. And so that was very purposeful in siting this terminal where it is.
And what used to be there at Kapalama was Snug Harbor with the University of Hawaii research vessels. They have been moved and you have filled in Snug Harbor.
That's correct. So before we could even start turning dirt at Kapalama Container Terminal, we needed to relocate all the tenants that were there. And so that took quite a bit of time. I would say, you know, 7 or so years leading up to when we broke ground at KCT. And so, like you said, as well as other harbor users that were at KCT, we relocated them. We built new facilities for some of them. And it really was all necessary to get us to where we are with KCT.
And the idea is that phase one of the money went toward basically leveling all those buildings and getting some of that foundation set. And then you've got phase two, which is the water side, which is a bigger contract.
So the construction and the whole project was organized into two phases. Phase one is the land side. So the actual cargo yard, and then the areas where our tenant would, you know, build their administrative buildings and maintenance areas. The second phase is the water side. So it's the wharf. It is the 1,800 linear feet of new berth space. And it's all the work that needs to happen on that wharf. So it is the crane rail beams. It is the dredging of the berth on the water side. And across the whole project, right, it is making sure we have water and power and other utilities to the site to make it, you know, a truly modern cargo terminal.
And you have had some delays. There were some issues with the coral in the water and a water line. Talk about that.
We had two significant delays in the second phase of the project. On the water side, when you do work in water, there's always greater risk. And so with the coral, we had studied the conditions. We knew we'd have to relocate coral. We knew we'd have to mitigate. But when we went to relocate the coral heads, what we expected to find was not what we found. And so we needed to revise the conditions of the permits, working with both federal and state agencies to make sure that we could satisfy what the permit required. And then secondarily, there was a delay. There's a water line that connects Sand Island to Kapalama Container Terminal. We needed to relocate that in order to rebuild the new pier. And in the process of building that, we had to redesign and reconstruct. So that, I think collectively with those two delays, it was almost a 2-year, you know, schedule shift, but we are really looking forward to completion of construction in about a year.
For people that maybe frequent this area here, what can they expect once you open up the terminal and you don't have the big trucks driving by?
Sure. So one big benefit of this terminal and its connection to its neighboring terminal, which is our Inner Island Barge Terminal, is that containers and cargo can be transferred from one terminal to another internally without having trucks carry the cargo, you know, across the Sand Island Bridge, onto Nimitz, and even through some of the surface streets between the terminals. So quite a bit of that cargo traffic is going to move just internally. So we might see some alleviation of the congestion on the roads. And once we complete this pretty, I mean, this is the largest capital improvement project that Harbors has undertaken in its history, but that's not where our work ends. We are going to be looking at redeveloping the Inner Island Barge Terminal at Piers 39 and 40, and then looking at Sand Island Container Terminal. A great deal of investment is needed in both areas, and really our eye is on making sure that our supply chain works how it's supposed to and that our waterfront facilities support not only the movement of cargo, but just supporting our state's economy and commerce.
And you have had to make adjustments to consider climate change and rising sea levels, and you've had to redesign, you know, some aspects of that to make it work.
So KCT, the wharf, is built 3 feet higher than the neighboring piers. And that was just a feature of the design because we knew sea level rise was a thing that we needed to plan for. As we consider the redevelopment of the neighboring piers and terminals, we're being a little more careful and thoughtful about how we study these projections and how we redesign the redevelopment. In not all cases will we need to raise the pier heights by 3 feet. It could be a different measure, or it could be another mitigation or adaptation, like changing the drainage systems at our terminals. So we are very carefully starting the study of that and just making sure that we are appropriately redesigning and rebuilding our facilities. But one feature of KCT, right, with the 3 feet and that connection to the neighboring Inner Island Barge Terminal, is we've got to make sure that the containers and the heavy equipment that carry those containers can safely move between the terminals. So that is another component of the project. It is related to KCT, but not exactly part of the KCT scope. We are working with the city to rebuild a storm drain and a box culvert that run in that transition area, just to make sure that operationally the drainage system does what the city needs it to do to move stormwater to the outfalls into the harbor, and it does what we need it to do, which is support the movement of the containers between the two terminals.
And then the whole idea of once Pesha moves out of the Sand Island area, Matson will then have more space to move out, and then whatever upgrades need to be done. But the whole idea is, what's the vision for the future? How do we make the space that we've got work for us?
Great question. So for us, and for now, just given how we understand cargo moves into and through our state, for us, it's really the more space we have, the more efficient the movements can occur. And so our job as Hawaii Department of Transportation is to make sure we maintain and we build these facilities to absolutely support that efficiency. So we do work with our harbor users. You know, once Pesha moves into KCT, Matson is going to take over the Sand Island Container Terminal, and its operations will have that much more space, and we should see those operational efficiencies. So our vision for the future is just ensuring that, one, our waterfront facilities keep up with the pace of cargo volumes and how our private partners move cargo and run their operations. And we really just want to make sure that our facilities do its job and allow for vessels to get into the port, discharge the cargo, that cargo can get onto trucks and get to, you know, store shelves. We run on a just-in-time supply chain, much more so than I think most other, you know, states and cities across the United States. But because it is so just-in-time, it's not uncommon to see a ship pull in, a container get off that ship, get on a truck, and go straight to, you know, the parking lot of, you know, our neighborhood grocery store. You know, we just want to make sure that our infrastructure really supports that and doesn't impede commerce.
That was Dre Khalili, Deputy Harbors Director, talking about the construction at the Kapalama Terminal. It's a key piece of the Harbor Modernization Project. Look for links for more information on our website later today. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. Hawaii.
For today's Backyard Quiz, we're exploring the history of an influential politician. We're looking for you to name the public servant who was described in his biography as a cowboy, engineer, and statesman. The man we're thinking of learned his cowboy skills growing up in Wyoming at the turn of the 20th century. He arrived in Hawaii after earning his engineering degree at the University of Nebraska. The letter that brought him here read, "Your first job will be on the Waihole Tunnel in the Ko'olau Mountains at a salary of $95 a month. You've come to the islands at an important time." He went on to become a member of the territorial legislature, elected in 1928 to represent the 5th District. He befriended U.S. Senator Hiram Fong, who even wrote the introduction to his biography. And our mystery man's last public office was as director of the Tax Foundation for the Territory of Hawaii, serving from 1946 to 1954. Today, we're looking for the name of this historic figure. Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HBR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Last December, Mexico completed a big infrastructure project, the Maya Train. It was supposed to be a boon to the local economy, but I haven't even seen the train, says this Yucatan resident. How the Maya train fell short of its goals, next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaiian Airlines, connecting Hawaii with international destinations including Japan, Australia, New Zealand, and South Korea. Schedules and reservations at hawaiianairlines.com/international.
You know, the United Nations designated Friday, October 11th, the International Day of the Girl. It was meant to draw attention to the challenges of growing up female. One of the topics that some researchers are looking to address is the soaring cost of childcare in Hawaii, which some call a crisis. Hannah Gardner is a researcher with the Institute for Women's Policy Research, a Washington, D.C.-based think tank focused on shaping public policy and improving opportunities for women. Gardner was in Hawaii this week and made a trip to our studio along with Alika Morgan, executive director of the Oahu nonprofit Nurturing Wahine Fund. They spoke with the conversation's Russell Subiono.
What seems to be driving up the cost of childcare for many? From a national perspective, can you talk about what many are calling a childcare crisis?
What drives this crisis is, well, first of all, the undervaluation of care work in general. Childcare work is an extremely undervalued field where predominantly women work in. Here in Hawaii, a childcare worker makes about $36,000 a year. That's $17 an hour. And so that makes childcare workers leave their jobs to find higher paying ones. And that in turn is causing this shortage in childcare workers that shrinks the childcare supply, that causes prices to go up, and mostly it affects families with young children and those with low incomes.
It almost seems parallel to teachers, where teachers are underpaid and still working toward getting to a point where they're paid in accordance with the value that they have. Alika, your organization is here in Hawaii. What does it look like here?
So I, as a parent, my husband and I, we pay $2,600 a month for childcare, and that does not include meals. And that is about half of mortgage. And I think a lot of moms experience the need to find safe, affordable, accessible childcare in our communities. But moms have become somewhat of a social safety net, where it is a full-time job, but it's not treated as such. And the U.S. is the only developed country that doesn't invest really in childcare. I think it's 0.3% of our GDP Wow. is in childcare cost, which is below the national average and global average for other countries. And so I think that here in Hawaii, we have our own childcare crisis with the undersupply of childcare. And, you know, we need to find, with no federal paid leave, a maternal health crisis, a gender pay gap in Hawaii, the cost of childcare is overwhelming.
How did we get to this point?
Really, it stems from a long history of underinvestment in the care sector, including the childcare sector. And this is a nationwide issue, but it really is quite dramatic here in Hawaii. And again, access to affordable, accessible, and quality childcare is essential for the long-term welfare of children and their families. It allows parents to go to work or attend school, and it also promotes gender equity by supporting labor force participation, better pay, career advancement. And so that's why it's so pivotal to really invest into the childcare system, which hasn't been done in the past, or at least not sufficiently enough. It's actually interesting because a new study just came out this month by researchers from Brown and Yale University, and they proved that spending on childcare is one of the most effective pro-work policies ever evaluated in the U.S., and that universal pre-K increases parents' earnings by 21%, and that those gains last for about 6 years. So it really just shows that investing in childcare is extremely important for both the economic well-being of families and the economy, yeah. Right?
Yeah, just echoing what Hannah said, research has shown from Moms First, they're an organization that's trying to get childcare on the record. Yeah. And Moms First has data that companies see up to 435% return on investment when they invest in childcare benefits. And so I think the messaging needs to go out that not only is in childcare important for moms, it's not just a mom's issue, it's an economic issue, and it is an issue that could benefit entire communities, right?
In your experience here, are there cultural either stigma or customs or just perspectives or philosophies that also impact the need for childcare here?
I would say so. I think that we recently attended a community baby shower, and afterwards we talked with the moms. Then we were asking the moms, what do they need? Like, we want to know your needs so that we can advocate for you. And a lot of moms were saying that they enjoy staying home and they want to be with their families, but it was also they had no other option. Mm. So there's a lack of options here.
Can I actually add something to that? Because I, as a researcher, I love talking about the data and what the numbers say. So to Alika's point, with childcare being so limited and, you know, unavailable and so highly expensive, that causes gender gaps in labor force participation and part-time employment. And we see this especially among parents with young children, so with children under six. And so we did run some numbers for Hawaii, and we see that for parents with children under six, 92% of dads are in the workforce compared to 69% of moms. Mm-hmm. And 9% of dads work part-time compared to 28% of moms. So you just see, you know, again, moms are more likely to either reduce their working hours and work part-time or drop out of the workforce entirely to take care of their children at home because childcare is so unavailable and so expensive here.
Yeah. Hannah, what is being done at a national level to address this lack of options or the shortage of workers in the childcare industry? What are some of the ideas or solutions you see filtering down to communities?
Yeah, I mean, I will point out that because I work primarily with data, the policy side of things are not my strong suit. However, first of all, investing in childcare is a win-win for both families and the economy. And so what is important is to have policies in place that support childcare as a public good. So making childcare accessible, readily available, affordable, and high quality. Establishing paid leave at the federal level is really important. That includes paid sick leave, paid family leave, and so on. Here in Hawaii, actually, there is legislation that aims to address the workforce shortage of care workers and legislation that aims to adequately compensate and retain childcare workers. Yeah. So that's a big thing. We need to compensate the people who take care of our communities. And that includes childcare, but also care of elderly or people with disabilities. Those are all jobs that are extremely undervalued.
Alika, I read that the Nurturing Wahine Fund recently did a statewide wellness survey. Based on some of the preliminary findings, how is that data factoring into the way that your organization is approaching the childcare crisis?
Yeah, thank you for asking. Yeah. We found that the undersupply of childcare options is affecting the mental health and wellness of moms in Hawaii. The respondents of the survey were mostly women in leadership roles at nonprofits who also serve as caregivers of children. And 61.5% of the moms said that the role of a caregiver impacts their mental health. And 84.6% of them did not consider leaving their organizations due to the lack of support. So what we concluded was that, and we're still doing the surveys, this is a preliminary result, but we've concluded that while women as caregivers experience mental health impacts, they generally don't consider leaving their jobs. And we're still looking at to why that is, but there's a strong commitment to their organization despite these personal challenges. And so that's why we've been distributing wellness grants to women across the state, because we want to close that gap.
It's interesting because your survey, Alika, your results are in line with the results of our poll that we did in 2021, which was a poll about, you know, what women want post-pandemic. And we saw that 3 out of 4 women want paid sick and paid family leave. 3 out of 4 women, right? It's a large number. 3 out of 4 adults find it important for Congress to pass legislation that expands access to affordable quality care. And 2/3 of adults say childcare should be an important, if not top priority, for federal government to consider. So I think it's really important to see what families and parents need and want in order to enter and succeed in the workforce, but also that they have this burden lifted off their shoulders, the burden of having to take care and combining that with a job.
What do you feel the federal government and the local governments can do with that data? How should they be using that information to address solutions?
Generally speaking, I wish that any politician would look at what the numbers say and what the data say, how childcare relates to gender equity more broadly, and then make informed decisions based on that. We saw that pre-COVID, there's been an extreme lack of childcare options in Hawaii, and post-COVID too. I mean, the childcare sector as a whole has been far behind the rest of the economy in recovering jobs post-pandemic. And so I think any politician should really take that into account when they make their policies and legislative efforts.
For us, I think in Hawaii, it's all about collective action. We can be the leaders in this childcare crisis if we are able to work together. For example, Nurturing Wahine Fund is involved with the Hawaii Children's Action Network Paid Family Leave Coalition. And we could all support their efforts to get paid family leave in the state. And right now, I think moms are navigating doing temporary disability insurance and other survival tactics to get postpartum care. And we can look more into organizations working together to get some of these things passed. And then, as Hannah mentioned, you know, IWPR's research and this data, we can actually use that data to inform decisions here locally. And again, with organizations like Moms First, they're trying to get childcare on the record and they're encouraging moms to share their stories. Yeah. And the more we share our stories, the more we can see how much we relate to each other. And we have more in common with this than we think.
Hannah Gartner, Alika Morgan, thanks so much for coming into the station today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, that's mahalo. Awesome.
Yeah.
That was Nurturing Wahine Fund's Alika Morgan and Hannah Gardner with the Institute for Women's Policy Research. They were talking to HPR's Russell Subiono about what they see as a child care crisis here in Hawaii. And now it's time to unmask the identity of our Backyard Quiz question. Earlier in the show, we told you about an island transplant who came here to work as an engineer of a major public works project in Honolulu. He liked the island so much, he stayed and pivoted his career to public service. First elected to the territorial legislature in 1928, he became friends with a future U.S. Senator Hiram Fong. It was in the introduction of his 1971 biography of Nolly Smith, Cowboy Engineer Statesman, that Fong described him as a large, handsome, tan, robust, well-built man with a hearty laugh, a booming voice, and an outgoing personality. Even after he was well-established in public life in Hawaii, Smith made regular visits to his family home in Wyoming to take part in the annual Pioneer Days Rodeo. We stumped you on this one. We had no one winners for our quiz question. But if you have an idea for a quiz, please write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org.
This Saturday on The Real Deal, it's the music of Art Tatum, revered by masters of classical music as well as every jazz pianist of his time and since. Join me, Seth Marco, Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1 for The Real Deal. Art Tatum.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with internationally acclaimed Israeli writer Edgar Keret about his experiences during this past year of war. His family reflects multiple points of view. His parents were Holocaust survivors. His sister was a settler. His brother is left wing. Keret has been calling for a settlement to end the war and release the hostages. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
At a time of labor unrest, PBS Hawaii is to debut a documentary film about the labor movement and the rise of the working class here in Hawaii. So far this fall, we have seen a lockout against nurses at Kapi'olani Hospital for Women and Children, which ended after 22 days. Hotel workers walked off their jobs over the Labor Day weekend, and Local 5 Unite Here is in week 3 of a strike against Hilton. Today we talk about a film entitled Aucoin McElrath, The Struggle Never Ends. Film producer Chris Conybeare has long worked with CLEAR, the Center for Labor Education and Research at the University of Hawaii's West Oahu campus. He uses McElrath's story and legacy to tell the history of the working class in the islands through the eyes of this pretty remarkable woman during a movement dominated by men. Take a listen to this excerpt of Aucoin A.Q. McElrath in her fight for women's rights.
It was important for us to get the women interested in what the men were doing on the waterfront. Why? If they organized, they would have enough money to send their children to school. They would maybe be able to buy even a home if they saved enough money. And basically, of course, the ILWU was a male-dominated union. It's the warehousemen's and the longshoremen. And those jobs, certainly at different development times of the industry, were jobs were done largely by men who were strong. didn't require a lot of other things. But as technology changed, of course, you had a difference in the workforce. So my job at that time was to convince women. Yes, you support your men so that you will have a union. They will be able to sit down with the bosses, get what they need, and you will be able to meet those needs that you think are important to raising a family. Because I think a lot of longshore families were fairly large at that particular time. Mostly Hawaiians, of course.
And that was A.Q. Akwan McElrath, who sat down with the documentary's producer and director, Joy Chong-Stannard, back in November 2008, just weeks before her death. We talked with Chris Conybeare yesterday about this documentary that has been years in the making.
One of the reasons we did this documentary is because a lot of people don't know anymore who Akwan McElrath was. In fact, the whole problem of institutional and historic memory is a problem. As many of us get older, a lot of that memory goes away. Akwan McElrath was one of the most important leaders in Hawaii, a woman leader in terms of working for strong labor union and social justice issues. She spent her entire life promoting those things. She started as a student, as a volunteer with the ILWU, and she worked as a volunteer with them almost like a full-time job from the late 30s until 1950-something when she was actually hired as a social worker. She was instrumental in helping the union organize the sugar workers and helped organize the historic 1946 sugar strike, which actually brought about the first real labor democracy in Hawaii. The territory at that time had been completely controlled by the big five companies, and the sugar workers basically broke that hold and started something that was more like a democracy should be. She then helped the dock workers when they went on strike in 1949. And even after she retired in the 50s, she kept working for social justice issues, women's rights, the rights of older people, welfare rights, death with dignity, any of these big issues that we talk about, she was involved with. And part of the reason we wanted to do this is because a lot of the attention was paid to the men who were involved in these things. You know, the union was basically a male-dominated organization. I'm talking about the ILWU. Now, the men were progressive and wanted to do the right thing, but, you know, a woman was not one of their traditional sources of leadership. But Akwan basically used her influence to get things done and get things done in a very good fashion and basically did it without looking for any attention to herself. One of the reasons she was successful, she didn't try to, you know, take the limelight. She didn't try to be the star. And so for some of those reasons, she's not as well remembered as some of those other guys.
When I think of Akwan McElrath, I think also of Harriet Busalog, a female attorney, you know, during that time. Also, you know, just remarkable figure in Hawaii history as well.
Well, Akwan actually taught herself stenography so she could work at Harriet Busalog's office when Harriet was involved with the trial of the Hawaii Seven. That was the trial in the 1950s where the seven members of the union and their friends were accused of trying to overthrow the United States government by force and violence because they were members or alleged to be members of the Communist Party. They were all convicted, but then the U.S. Supreme Court several years later struck down all those convictions. But Akwan actually taught herself how to do stenography so she could go work with Harriet Busalog and help prepare the legal cases at that time. Akwan was probably, well, as one of the people in the documentary says, there was probably never a time she wasn't the smartest person in the room.
Well, were there any surprises when you were out there doing your research?
Well, they weren't surprises exactly, but because of working with Akwan over the years, she introduced us to her colleagues, her basically working class union guys, men and women, actually. And I was really privileged because she introduced me to these folks who helped make Hawaii history. And I was this sort of howly boy from Ohio And all of a sudden, I was sitting in their houses at night listening to all their stories and things. So maybe not surprises as much, but frankly, Akwan helped me have a whole understanding of sort of a history in Hawaii that we really don't teach.
I know that, you know, you've done lots of work over there at CLEAR. That is really a wonderful place to learn about the history of labor in this town.
If you recall back in the 80s, I had a television program called Rice and Roses, which
yes.
was about working class Hawaii. And through that television program, my colleague Joy Chong Standard and I interviewed lots of the people who helped make that working class history happen. And basically, we kept it all. So one of our challenges with this documentary was we had to raise money to preserve and digitize about 7,000 pieces of film and videotape so that we could actually bring those people back to the screen and incorporate some of their stories with Akwan in this documentary. So if people tune in, they're going to see a lot of historic footage, that really rare historic footage and interviews with some of these men who were responsible for, organizing the union and organizing against the Big Five in the 1930s and 40s.
I know this has been a labor of love for you. What did it feel like when you finally got it done? And
Well, I mean, it really was. I started thinking about this. Akwan died in 2008. And around 2010 or 2011, I started thinking, well, we should do something. Well, you know, it takes money. And I had all of that archival material, but it wasn't usable anymore because it was on old formats. So we had to raise money to preserve and digitize all of that material. That was about $150,000.
Wow.
And then we had to raise money, you know, for the documentary, for location shooting and for editing and for all of those other things. So altogether, we probably raised, and then we also had a website. So we probably raised $280,000 to make this all happen. But, you know, through the process in 2015, we really thought we were going to get it done in 2 years. Well, all kinds of things happened. Among them, of course, we had a pandemic in 2020, and we had in this last year, we had all kinds of other issues. And so it really just took us longer than we wanted it to. But finally, we're done. And we want people to see it. And we really want it to be used for future generations to see what one person's influence can be if they are resilient, if they have strength, and if they just don't give up. Akwan never gave up. She always came back. She always was ready to keep fighting. So she was a remarkable person, and I think inspirational. That's what we're hoping that comes across in this documentary.
That was Chris Conybeare, who along with Joy Chong Standard produced the documentary film on local labor leader Akwan McElroth. The title of the documentary, Akwan McElroth, The Struggle Never Ends. It debuts on PBS Hawaii on October 17th at 8:30 p.m. Look for links on our website later today. Up tomorrow, gosh, can you believe it's been 20 years since the hit TV show Lost filmed here in Hawaii? Well, there's a new documentary out. It's debuting at the Hawaii International Film Festival. We do welcome feedback. Call our talkback line 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Spotify, Apple, or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.